Good morning, everyone, members and people in the audience. Welcome to this special meeting of the joint meeting of the E-12 Education Committees, both in the Senate and the House. I want to welcome my colleagues from the Senate over to the State Office Building this morning. It's good to see you all here. This is a special meeting for me, two reasons, because one of your presenters here today is a brother. He's a gentleman who I've had the pleasure of working with, spanning back a good 15 years. And when he moved away a few years ago, Representative Growling, I was beside myself, but he went to a good place doing good work. And so I welcome him this morning. And it's also special because, of course, whenever we have an opportunity to interact with the Education Commission of the States, it's always a good value-added opportunity for us to be able to hear the folks working at the national level on issues of E-12 education that we're also working with and wrestling with here at the states. And, of course, a lot of our work is how do we align our state policies with national trends and policies as well. But before we get started, I thought what I would do is just go around the room quickly. We could all introduce ourselves to one another because this is an unusual gathering of both House and Senate members. And then once we do that, then I'll turn over to our guests from ECS for the presentation this morning. My name is Carlos Mariani, State Representative. I chair the K-12 Policy Committee here in the House, and I represent District 65D, which is the heart of St. Paul, and the capital actually sits in my district.
Cindy Grayling, I chair the K-12 Finance Committee. We're closely with Mr. Mariani in the House on education issues. I represent the district 10 minutes north of the capital and inner ring suburb, three cities.
And I'm going to turn to my left quickly here because I have another fellow chairperson here.
Chuck Wigger, Maplewood, North St. Paul. Let's go.
Hello.
Hi, Keith County, District 41A, Edina. Chair Mariani, State Health Policy Committee.
Bud Norris, the representative from District 10A. Also member of the Policy Committee.
Carol McFarland, 53D, White Bear Area. Republican lead on State Health Policy, and I'm on the Education Finance Committee.
Connie Depke, representative from District 33B, which is the Lake Minnetonka area, 11 towns around Lake Minnetonka. I serve both on the K-12 Policy Committee and the K-12 Finance Committee.
Good morning. I'm Jerry Newton. I represent 49B, which is primarily Coon Rapids, a little bit of Andover, and I also am on K-12 Finance, K-12 Policy.
Good morning. Mark Murdoch, representative of District 10B, the other half of the Bud Norris District, Center Children's District. Set on the K-12 policy, very interesting work in my mind because I don't have a teaching degree or a school board experience, so it was a huge learning curve. Have a good time.
I'm Will Morgan. I represent Burnsville and part of Savage, and I'm on the K-12 Finance Committee.
And Representative Bob Detmer, representing 52A, which is Northern Washington County, Eastern Anoka County, and I serve on the K-12 Education Finance, and I've been an educator for 34 years.
Representative Ward.
John Ward, Vice Chair of the K-12 Finance Committee, and represent District 12A, which is Brainerd, Baxter, Crosby, Arrington, Nisswa.
Corey Kass, Vice Chair of K-12 Education Policy, and I represent District 26A, which is Owatonna, Waseca, and a multitude of townships.
Representative John Benson, 43B, which is Minnetonka, Plymouth, and Wayzata. Hopkins School District, Wayzata School District, and Minnetonka School Districts are all in my district, and I serve on both the K-12 Policy and K-12 Finance Committee, two of my favorite committees.
Hi, I'm Paul Anderson, 13A, took by Heidrick's Place, and always stop at Charlie's Cafe in Freeport.
Kathy Breinert, I represent the Mankato area, and I serve on K-12 Policy.
Kevin Dahl, District 25, includes Northfield, Belle Plaine, New Prague, Le Sueur, and many other communities.
State Senator Dan Scogin, as you can see, Senate District 10, loves education. I've got both my housemates here, and we serve in Otter Tail and Wadena County.
Lisa Phoebe, Senator from District 16, all of Mille Lacs County, so Elk River, Big Lake, Becker, all the way up to Onamia, Isle, and including the great town of Princeton.
I'm Jen Olson, Senator of District 33. I'm County Deputy Senator and represent 20 cities in the Lake Minnetonka area. I serve on the lead on E12 Finance and serve in the combined policy committee as well. Also serve as an ECX commissioner and have for many years.
And I'm Kathy Saltzman, and I represent Central Washington County. I have four school districts off Washington County, Stillwater, Matanita, and North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, and I'm a state senator.
Good morning. My name is Kim Norton. I represent one half of the great city of Rochester. Serve on K-12 policy.
Representative Swales.
I'm Marcia Swales. I represent Woodbury and the community of Landfall. And I, in my other life, I'm an advanced placement English teacher at Woodbury High School.
And Representative Brown.
I'm Representative Brown. I represent District 27A. That's the Albert Lea area, southern Minnesota. And I teach when I'm not here.
Very well. Good morning again, and welcome to everyone. And welcome, gentlemen. I'll let the committee try to figure out which one of you two is my long-lost brother as we continue our work. We are scheduled to meet until 10:30. Mr. Vandell, I'm just wondering if I know we have a question and answer period here, but does it work for you and your colleague, Michael, I assume, to... to be interrupted with questions as you present, what would be your preference?
Oh, yeah, we're very comfortable with that. So as questions arise, feel free to stop us and we'll respond on the spot.
Very well. It is our custom to have testifiers identify themselves for the record because we do tape these proceedings. And so as you begin your testimony, if you can please do that. So again, welcome, brother, Dr. Vandell.
Chairman Mariani, Madam Chair Greiling, members of the Senate and the House committees, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. My name is Bruce Vandell. I am the Director of Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Development, as well as the state liaison to the state of Minnesota with the Education Commission of the States. And we appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning. We know you are all very, very busy in the heat of a very intense and very important session. And so we appreciate the chance to be able to share with you a little of the information that we have about what we're doing here at ECS and hopefully to introduce you to us a little bit more so that you might better utilize us and that you can work with us closely on education issues in the future. For some of you, you may not know who the Education Commission of the States are, so I thought I would take a couple of minutes to tell you about that. The Education Commission of the States is a national compact actually created by an act of Congress in 1965 of each of the 50 states. So if you were to dig through Minnesota state statute, you'd actually find a mention of Education Commission of the States and the participation of the state of Minnesota in that compact. Basically what that means is functionally two things. One is that as part of the commission, you are able to identify up to seven individuals who can represent you on the commission. And today we have three of your commissioners with you. Senator Olson had introduced herself as a commissioner, Representative Greiling, and Senator Wieger. We also have the Governor Pawlenty is a commissioner, as well as Commissioner Segrin. And now your new higher education office director, Metzen, is also a commissioner. And so that makes those, among others, are that represent the commission. And that what that means is that they can come to our national forum, or while all of you are invited, they actually function as part of the governance structure of the organization and represent us and try to make decisions on behalf of us.
And I would just add, the final commissioner is Representative Garofalo, recently appointed, and he is unable to be here today, but sends his greetings.
Yes, that's right. Brand new commissioner. Thank you, Representative.
So essentially, of course, the other thing that you do is you make a commitment to us annually, financially, to help support the organization, which is very important to our success. And of course, that means that we want to be a highly valuable and intricate resource to you in terms of the deliberations and the work that you're doing in the legislature and in the various education agencies here in Minnesota. Our ultimate purpose is to enlighten, equip, and engage, which essentially means to provide new information to you as we learn about new innovations in education policy throughout the country. We want to make sure that we make sure that information is available to you. And through our website, through meetings like this, through our various our national forum and other convenings over the course of the year, we want to provide you what is the cutting-edge information, who is doing the most interesting and exciting things in education policy, and that's part of our job is to get that information to you. To provide the information you need as you are pursuing a bill, looking at a particular issue, and you want to get a perspective on how other states are approaching that issue, ECS is a place that you can come to. So you should never hesitate to give us a call at a moment's notice, during session, out of session, any time, to be able to get a question answered about how are other states tackling a particular issue, what is the research saying about a particular issue, what are some interesting strategies that have been employed that have had success on a particular issue. So always feel free to connect with us at any time. And of course, lastly, to engage, to provide opportunities for you through our national forum and our other meetings to connect with people from around the country on education policy issues. The reason that we're here in Minnesota today, in addition to speaking with you, is we have our spring steering committee meeting going on at Minneapolis Hilton. And as you may know, our chair at ECS this year is Governor Pawlenty. So by virtue of his chairmanship, we are having our spring meeting here. And of course, he's providing leadership to our organization over the next 2 years. And so it's been fantastic working with the governor. He's done a wonderful job on behalf of ECS. And so to that extent, we want to especially make sure that we're providing services that are valuable to you here in Minnesota. Some of the things that we do very specifically, as I mentioned, we provide information and news about what's happening in education policy. We conduct policy research and analysis. You'll hear about some of that a little bit later today on some of the issues. If you haven't been to our website, I encourage you to do so. This is the site here. It'll pop up. It has a variety of information. It's actually a pretty amazing resource in terms of we have databases, 50 state policy databases on a number of issues, a very, very wide range of issues. Obviously putting the most recent research and educational policy up on that website. So at the click of a mouse, you can get to our website and find out a lot of the most current and interesting and important information in education policy around the country. Get back to that PowerPoint here. In addition, as I mentioned, we convene state, regional, and national policy conferences. Our national forum is our largest event, which takes place this year in Nashville, Tennessee on July 8th through 10th. So if you have some time and resources, we'd love to have you come out. We'll have a wonderful slate of speakers, national speakers, and opportunities to learn about various education policies. We also do regional meetings and, of course, our steering committee meetings, which are twice a year. We promote networks and partnerships, looking for opportunities to work with all of the different education policy organizations across the country, looking for ways that we can provide and pull together our resources so that we can serve you better. And we also do customized technical assistance. So if there's an opportunity where you need greater research done, a specific set of issues looked into, we're available to be able to do that in depth as at your request. And so these are sort of the full range of services that we have available, and we're happy to provide them to you at any time. So that's ECS in a nutshell. What I thought I would do very briefly before we get into the other items on the agenda is just tell you a little bit about what we're going to be talking about at our steering committee meeting today and tomorrow. We're convening this evening at the Minneapolis Hilton, and then all day tomorrow we'll be meeting and talking about the issue of how we can better align education and workforce policy. As you know, the current economic situation really begs the question of how we can make sure we leverage every asset and resource we have towards getting people the jobs they need, the skills they need, in order to be able to be successful in a very different economy that's changing very, very rapidly. And so we have dedicated this year at ECF to really pursue that question in some depth. And so we thought it would be important to work with our commissioners, work with our steering committee members over the course of these next several months to identify what are the key issues that you're concerned about, what are the policy levers that we think that we can influence or give you good information on, and then develop a strategy for how we can provide assistance to states over the next years, couple of years, especially during this very, very challenging time, to be able to identify how to best leverage your education assets to really serve your economic goals, first in terms of both in terms of educating your workforce and also in terms of economic development strategies broadly. So very briefly, there's a lengthy PowerPoint in your packet. So I'm just going to go through the high points for you today so that we can get into the other parts of the agenda. But what we'll be talking about really is this question of how do we better align, first of all, the supply of students that we have to serve. And as you think about education policy, and right now in particular, as you look at what's going on at our universities, there's a very diverse population of people that access our education system. Of course, the traditional K-12 pipeline has a very economically and ethnically and racially and culturally diverse population in Minnesota, as well as many, many other states. Is how is it we're going to serve those students as they enter our system? Likewise, as you look into post-secondary education, there's those students and then others, those who have are in low-skilled jobs and are looking for additional training in order to be able to be competitive in the workforce, those who have been in well-paying jobs in the manufacturing or other industries that have been downsized to be able to get the training they need in order to be able to change their and update their skills and become competitive. And of course, those populations, adults and others that maybe never did graduate from high school and are looking for finally getting the skills they need in order to be able to provide opportunities for themselves and their families. And so on one level, that's supply of students. And on the other side is, of course, what is the demand in your workforce? What are the jobs that are available? What are the industries that have high need? What are employers telling us about what kind of skills are valued in the workforce? And figuring out a way for the education system to be able to serve this diverse population of students while also being responsive to what the workforce demands in a very rapidly changing economy. So as we've had our conversations, and we started our conversations last fall at our steering committee meeting, and we talked about the variety of pathways that students access the system, and came up with really four key policy levers that we want to study in more depth, and we'll be talking about during our steering committee meeting today and tomorrow. And the first is, of course, how do we identify and teach the right skills and content that students need today? And as you know, over the last 8 years, with No Child Left Behind, there's been a tremendous emphasis on the right content, the right knowledge that students need in order to be successful. If you've been paying attention to some of the innovations that are happening, what's coming out of the Department of Education in Washington and with many other states, there's also a conversation about the right skills that students need. Some call it soft skills, some call it 21st century skills, some call it workforce skills. But nevertheless, in most states and the standards that they've set, and also, of course, the expectations that the federal government has placed upon you, there hasn't been a great emphasis of late on this. Now, Minnesota was actually many years thinking about these issues when it had the profiles in learning and it has done a lot of work, but now there's a revisiting of that question. What are the right skills? What is the right content that students need to be learning both in K-12 and post-secondary in order to be successful? And so we're having a conversation again about how do we use our state standards, what can accountability systems do in order to be able to capture the full range of knowledge that students need in order to be successful. And of course, the follow-up question that inevitably comes up when we talk about this is how do we assess those skills and how do we assess that knowledge and how do we do it efficiently, effectively, in a manner that's going to get information into the hands of educators in a timely fashion, that's going to be responsive to what the skill demands are in the workforce. It's a very challenging question, and we'll be talking a bit about that as well over the next couple of days. Third, a conversation about how do we deliver instruction? How do we ensure that we're meeting the needs of a very diverse population of students, both in K-12 and post-secondary education, to make sure they get the skills they need in the timely fashion that they require in order to quickly get into the workforce? whether that's traditional high school students, whether that's people coming back to post-secondary education after being out for quite some time. We want to make sure we're looking at the system and seeing to the extent that it's aligned and connected in a way to ensure that students can get the skills and training they need in a timely fashion. And then lastly, responding to workforce demand. How is it that the education system can be knowledgeable about and constantly looking at good data that tells them, here is what the skills that are needed, here is where the job opportunities are, how can we create opportunities to be able to get people into those jobs by providing them the training they need? Very quickly, so if you look at this from a visual point of view, we have, of course, in the K-12 system, the emphasis on the specific sets of skills and knowledge that students are interested in, or that we need to provide to them. Of course, there's what the post-secondary education systems are delivering. And of course, this new area we're calling 21st century skills, to identify how do we integrate those important soft skills, workforce skills that students need, how do we measure them, how do we provide opportunities for students to apply the knowledge that they learn so that they can hit the workforce ready to do what's needed to be successful. And of course, at the end of the day, it's all about how does that integrate into the workforce in terms of the job-related skills that employers are seeking.
Mr. Vandell, if I can just interrupt quickly back on your other slide. So identifying and teaching the right skills, I see a heavy emphasis and a good emphasis on content areas, subject areas that apparently match up with, you know, the nature of our economy right now. But what about the other skills that we tend to describe as soft skills?
Mm-hmm.
How does that figure in, if at all, in terms of your the model and ECS's approach to being able to advance the discussion in K-12 education?
Right. I think that's really the critical issue that we're dealing with right now. If you look at state systems, the standards that they've identified, how can we begin to integrate those skills in some way into state standards and also what ends up being taught and then measured in some meaningful way. And so the challenge that we've heard is, over the years, as I mentioned, there's sort of a pendulum that seems to go back and forth between a focus on content versus a focus on skills. And I think the general consensus now is, and that really gets to this first bullet here in terms of key principles, is that we need both. There's no question that it's one thing to have the knowledge, but it's another thing to be able to use that knowledge and apply that knowledge and have the skills to be able to innovate, to be entrepreneurial, to be lifelong learners, to be able to work with others. And so the question is, first of all, how do we embed those dimensions, those skills, into a state system? And then second of all, how do we assess those skills? And that's really the challenge, and I think one of the arguments that we've heard from many is that, well, it's just too complicated, it's not easy to assess these skills, and therefore we probably shouldn't be including them in any kind of accountability system, and that if we put those in there, it's going to sacrifice content. And I think our argument is, and the conversation we're having is, that no, it does not have to sacrifice content. You don't have to compromise when it comes to being able to set up a system. You should be able to set up standards that include both. And that with new innovation in assessment and measurement, we're getting a better handle on how it is that we can, within one assessment program, be able to actually measure whether or not students not only have the knowledge, but also can apply that knowledge in meaningful ways. And so that's the conversation we're beginning to have with states, is how is it we can look at your systems, how can you begin to recognize the new opportunities in terms of assessment, and look at ways to incorporate the skills, those types of skills, into your state standards or into your education system.
And one of the things we struggle with, Dr. Vandell, is that our current assessment system, many of us nonetheless feel that our current assessment systems have become sort of the tail wagging the dog, that because of the need to filter through outcomes through the present system,
mm-hmm.
that the system, the assessment system itself, then precludes the ability to move into areas beyond content knowledge. So, well, one of the things we've been doing for the past 2 years is looking at alternative assessment systems and trying to do that boldly, but we're discovering it's very difficult work to do, both in terms of the work, but also politically as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of states that are definitely looking at different ways to be able to document student learning. There are states that are using portfolios in addition to assessments to be able to identify how students are applying skills. So there's a lot of different innovation happening, and I think you're going to see over the next couple of years, as we, with the leadership in Washington and also with states that are forging ahead, there are many states that are part of, for example, one initiative is the Skills for the 21st Century, Partnership 21st Century Skills, where there are several states that are working together that are looking at ways to better integrate some of these skills into their systems, which will then, of course, impact assessments and their standards. So.
And I know this jumps ahead in your presentation. Yeah. I apologize, but what is your sense of just how rapidly or aggressively the current administration in D.C. Is at this point in regards to these issues? So I'm hearing conflicting messages that, you know, you're probably a good year away before you see some massive suggestions within the NCLB framework, but then I'm also hearing that there's some, you know, quick, aggressive efforts on the part of the Obama administration to address these issues as quickly as possible. Do you have a sense of ECS? Probably no better than anyone else. But do you have a sense of...
I think we're all sort of waiting to see how the administration... I mean, obviously, they're still getting themselves in place in terms of that. I think there's been a lot of conversation. You've heard a lot of already from Secretary Duncan, an interest in this area. I think the question is when and how that is going to come to fruition. I think that, and Mike will talk more about this, and feel free to comment now, Mike, in terms of the race to the top, and that opportunity and how that probably will drive a lot of the innovation in terms of some of these areas. So,
Professor Debra has a question.
Yeah. Sir, where do you see Minnesota in the pendulum or in the spectrum compared to other states?
Well, I think you've had the conversation in the past, and I think that positions you well in the future to be able to continue to have these dialogues and conversations. There are many states that are forging ahead pretty rapidly in the Northeast. Many of the states have already begun a conversation about how to incorporate skills, and in fact, they're working together very closely, some of the states in the Northeast, to be able to find ways to create efficiencies as it relates to assessments, developing assessments, and identifying ways they can measure skills. So states working together to be able to save resources. West Virginia is another state that's moved ahead on these issues. So I would say that Minnesota is not where they're at, but you're also not, you're obviously not at the beginning point either. So I would sort of put you maybe in that middle area. I don't know. Maybe I should invite Kathy to come up as well. Since she's sitting over there, she could probably add to the conversation.
Come on up, Kathy.
Yeah. You want to come on up?
And I realize I'm breaking up your presentation here, but I also want to make sure we engage the committee members in with you, all three of you. So.
This Good is, morning. By the way, Kathy Christie, who is our chief of staff at ECS, and she'll be talking to you a little bit about some of the high school and community services, and Michael Griffiths, who is our senior policy analyst working on school finance issues. But I want to make sure that they can feel free to jump in at this point. So.
Very well.
I'll respond to the Minnesota question, and that...
You'll need to say your name for our...
Oh,
for the
I'm sorry, Kathy Christie. We just did four policy briefs on the race to the top, the four goals that have been set out for the stimulus fund. So if you want to see some good state examples of what states have been doing prior to this time, even to reach the type of goals that have been established there, I would suggest on our website there on the main page, and you can access those at any time. But Minnesota is usually on my list of certainly forward-thinking states.
Great. Dr. Vanda.
Just to wrap up then, in terms of some of the key principles that we think are important, we've actually already begun to address them, that of course the need to include both content and skills and embed them in standards, assessment, and curriculum. To ensure that standards and curriculum are responsive to the skills and demand by the workforce. So I think that's another critical challenge, is as the workforce changes, as skills change and evolve, how is it that we're creating a system that's able to be reviewed, evaluated, has the right players at the table, so that it's not something where you're setting a set of standards in stone and then finding out later that you're behind the curve. How do you create a system that's responsive, that can change over time, that can be tweaked and changed and revised to meet the changing needs within your state and your region?
I
Another key issue that we're very interested in exploring with states is moving away from this notion of students completing education through seat time and more about demonstrating their capacity and competency, whether that's in K-12 or in post-secondary education. What are the ways that we can move students along so that if they demonstrate capacity, to be able to move them on to that next level, get away from the strict grade structures maybe so much, and thinking about moving students rapidly if they can, or providing the support that they need if they're falling behind. And so I think that's another area that we think is integral to this conversation. As I mentioned before, how do we ensure that instruction can be delivered in many different ways? It can meet the unique needs of students, that we're not doing a one-size-fits-all, but we're creating systems in order to be able to deliver instruction that meets the needs of students. So that involves, how are we training our teachers? How are we preparing teachers? How are we ensuring that those teacher preparation institutions are knowledgeable of and are adapting their programs to meet the unique needs of a diverse population of students? We think that's very important to the equation. And then, of course, how are we creating strong data systems, not only within K-12 and post-secondary education, linking them, but also to the extent that you're ultimately linking it to workforce systems, so that you can see not only how you're doing within the system, but then when people leave the system, what happens? Are they getting employed? What kind of earnings do they have? Do they have the right match of skills in order to be effective in the workforce? So we think these key principles, while some of them might be down the road a piece for some states, are important to put on the table and to begin a conversation about how we might move in that direction. So over the next couple of days, if you have a chance and you'd like to, feel free to drop by our steering committee. We're at the Minneapolis Hilton all day tomorrow, and we'll be having those conversations. And hopefully the results of that will be a longer-term strategy for ECS about how we can support and work with states on these key issues.
Mr. Chairman?
I hear a voice. Senator Hahn.
Can I ask a question of our...
Please do.
Is it the Dr. Zander?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm just, and I apologize, I'm not, a little bit late, and I'm not familiar with your organization very extensively. I guess I've heard of it, but, and I've been looking and listening to your presentation. My question is, the things I'm reading and the things you're talking about seem to be suggesting that education is essentially training people for jobs. And my question is, if that's the case, why do we engage the state in doing this, and why do we have statements in our state constitution that are contrary to that, and why do we have statements by the federal government in the articles or the Northwest Ordinance that say nothing about training people for jobs? What is the decision? Where was that decision made that education is essentially and primarily about training people to be able to get jobs, and why do we do that?
Senator,
Dr. Vandell.
Chairman. Well, first of all, of course, we would not argue that that education is exclusively for training and preparing people from the workforce. In fact, one of our key departments at our organization is called the National Center for Learning and Citizenship, and we'll argue just as vehemently and strongly that education is about preparing people for citizenship and for contributing to society in many larger and different ways. So we would never argue that education is exclusively about preparing people for the workforce. We're just arguing at this point, with current situations as they are, we think it's important to be looking at how we can better leverage our educational investments, given what many citizens are dealing with in terms of the economy and their need to be retrained and to participate. So I think in terms of answering your question, I think that's where we would argue, we could just as vehemently argue the other issues as it relates to this. All we're trying to do is have that larger conversation about what is the connection at this time, and we would never want to compromise these other important aspects. We strongly believe in the benefits of a liberal education as well.
So. Fair question. We have been joined by Senator Hahn as well as Senator Rummel, Representative Faust, Representative Moon, Representative Peterson, and Representative Swarwick. Welcome to all of you. Representative Swales, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am very interested in the last item that you mentioned about technical assistance. I know that the state of Wyoming and I believe Oklahoma have what we call a SIF program, an interoperability framework that connects school districts with their departments of education and so forth. In Minnesota, we have, I think, a progressive movement toward that, but it feels almost like we have competing frameworks going on.
We have an excellent system going through the Department of Education here, but then we have another system that is through a cooperative and through it's called TIDES, and so they have their own system. Is there ways that you could assist our state in being able to bridge those systems so that we begin, I mean, what we need is an infrastructure for this technology to be able to get the districts horizontally linked and then to be able to deal with what we need to do with the Department of Education. And I'm just wondering if you are looking at those issues, and because that saves tens of millions of dollars.
Dr. Vandell or Ms. Christie?
I'm going to defer to Kathy.
We are a managing partner with the Data Quality Campaign. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. The leader of that campaign actually lives in Minnesota, Amy Gadara. And the next generation of that work will be to do exactly what you're asking for. And I believe that the DTC right now is working on an action plan for how to do that more efficiently over the next 12 months.
Dr. Vandell.
Well, that's in terms of what we're going to be working on, that's about it. Obviously, we want to invite you to participate in tomorrow's meeting and also to join us at our national forum coming up in Nashville. And as the representative mentioned, do not hesitate to contact us in terms of being able to provide assistance in any way we can. It's from the smallest information request to a larger set of questions about services that we can provide. Do not hesitate. With that, I'd like to introduce Michael Griffith, who is our senior finance analyst at the Education Commission of the States. And Mike has been spending a great deal of time looking at the ARRA Act and looking at ways in terms of the impact it's going to have on states, how states might expect that resources might flow, and answer any questions you might have on that for the next several minutes. So I'm going to hand it over to Mike.
Welcome, Mr. Griffin. We're very anxious to hear your presentation. I was told that perhaps you were the individual from ECS that worked, I think, a couple years ago, perhaps, with PS Minnesota here in our state, which worked very competently over a long period of time to develop the platform from which the Minnesota Miracle proposed legislation to reform our state finance system is before us. And the little bird told me that you were part of the expert group that came and assisted good people here in Minnesota in developing that. And I see you nodding, so it must be true. So I want to just acknowledge that and thank you for your help with that. But please do state your name for the record.
Okay.
And
Mike Griffiths, Senior School Finance Analyst for the Education Commission of the State. The Reinvestment Act is about 1,200 pages, 200 of which is education-related, 150 pages so far of regulations, about 25 to 50 pages of regulations coming out each week now. I'm going to try to summarize all that in 10 minutes. So if I go too fast, if I skip over something, please stop me. Trying to break it down so it's easy to understand, and actually, you know, you're getting so much information now about this, and it becomes very confusing. About $700 billion are in the Reinvestment Act, $100 billion of which goes to education, $80 billion of which goes to K-12 education. The easiest way to think about that $80 billion breaks down into three streams. The first is increasing current programs. This includes IDEA, which is the special education money, Title I, and some of the other federal programs that have been ongoing over the years. Then a $48 billion or so in new money. This is for the state's fiscal stabilization fund that is out there. And then finally, the competitive grants, the largest of which is the Race to the Top, but there's also an incentive grant program and some other smaller ones we'll talk about. Under the current programs, the state doesn't have an awful lot of say. It's Title I formula driven for most of the money, or IDEA formula driven. It goes directly to the states or to the school districts in some cases. In other cases, it passes through the state, but the state really can't do anything with it. We'll talk about this in a few seconds. I think there is a role for the state with this, but there's not an awful lot you can do to mandate how districts spend it. The new program money, we thought there'd be a lot more control in the beginning. The understanding generally was the money would go to the state would distribute it out, and then could tell the district how to spend that. We've learned recently that that's not the case, and again, we'll talk about this in a second. And then finally, the competitive grants, which there's been an awful lot of interest in, as we move around, I'll try to give you an idea where it's at right now and what we know, but there's an awful lot that we don't know about the competitive grants. This is the Title I money. The first allotment actually went out at the beginning of the month. Your school district should have received some of these payments already, and they receive 50% now. The other 50% they'll receive sometime between July and September. The feds haven't decided yet. Even though they're getting 100% of this money now, it's considered a distribution over this year and next year. Title I money, although the state doesn't deal with it that much, it has a very specific way that you can spend it. In the first 18 months, you have to allocate your funding. But you can allocate it, but you don't need to spend it. Districts have up to 5 years to spend this money. So when talking to districts, in some cases, you might just want to let them know that. If they don't have to spend it right away, they can. They can spread it out over time. They can spend it on anything that's allowable under Title I, which is fairly large. But once you place the money into Title I spending, so for instance, if a teacher is designated as Title I, after the 2 years is over, you're still going to have to fund that teacher because there's with state money or with local money, because there is a supplement, not supplant, provision within Title I. So you're essentially locking that teacher in for eternity to be a Title I teacher. And so you have to think carefully before you do that.
Mr. Griffith, I'm going to stop you quickly.
Sure.
I think it generated a couple of interests from members, Representative Slawick, Representative Detmer, and Senator Saltzman. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're specifically considering Title I for early childhood, and I'm trying to figure out how we could, if we have to convince the school
sure.
to spend it that way, right? But particularly for early reading,
The only thing you can really do, I mean, one, you can set out recommendations to say these are the ways you could spend the money without running into a problem after year two. And the other thing you can do is if you could create a small pot of state money and say you're going to use that as a matching grant for Title I, then you could use that as influence. In some cases, I'll be honest, I went out and spoke with the National School Boards Association a couple of weeks ago. Their complaint is, from the school district's view, we don't know how to spend the money. We're struggling right now figuring out how to spend our Title I money. I think if you gave them some guidance, it would really help. And I think if you said, look, here's preschool or after-school programs or summer school, these are pretty effective programs. You can get them going for 2 years. Then after the 2 years is over, maybe we can find the money to continue them, but if we don't, then you know, then they'll fade away. But at least you have those 2 years of value added. But you can't force them to do anything. And so that's one of the difficulties.
Representative Swales. Senator Paulson.
Okay. On the Title I wonder if you could just clarify for me, because this just doesn't seem like very smart policy, that we're with these dollars that are in Title I, that once a district commits, then somewhere in 2 years, we're going to have to find the money to continue funding that program. I just wonder if any of the other states, or personally, why there isn't just some sort of pushback on this. This is not, it's sort of funding the status quo. And in talking with some folks who are involved on the national level, who I work with on other issues, mm-hmm. you know, there's all this discussion of change, and we have just invested millions of dollars into not prevention programs or not early intervention. We're funding the problem. And I don't know, I mean, I guess everybody is hesitant to express displeasure with this because it's money, but at the same time, this is not going to produce the change, I don't think, that I think is really critical if we're going to change the way we educate children. Have you heard any, has anyone been as vocal as maybe I am right now with not feeling a sense of what are we going to do in 2 years? We're going to have a mess.
Mr. Griffin, we counted Senator Saltzman to be our vocal member.
Yes, I was going to say, I actually should have timed it. What time is it? That usually it's quicker in a meeting that I get that question. Yes. Every meeting I've been into, it doesn't matter if I'm talking to state people or district people or people who deal with education in general, that question comes up. Title I, the reason this was done originally is the feeling was Title I was underfunded. And so that actually this was the first provision put in the Recovery Act dealing with education, and that they were going to increase Title I funding. The other stuff kind of came later. But you run into that problem. If it's only a two-year increase and then the 2 years fades away, then you're locked into dealing with these programs. The other thing is there's not a heck of a lot of flexibility within Title I. There's very specific ways you need to fund programs. They're sensing that now on the Fed level. So what they did is they came up with a set of guidelines and tried to loosen up the spending for this new Title I money. There's a problem with Title I, though, that it's a Gordian knot type of thing, that it all works together very structured. If you loosen one strand, you're causing problems with the whole thing. They realized their first go around with the guidelines, loosening it up, didn't work. So they're trying to go back again. There's a chance, it's still possible, that they can offer a two-year waiver on Title I and say, go ahead and spend it how you want for this two-year period, and then we're going to get back to the old set of rules after 2 years. But getting back, are you just funding the same old programs in the same old way? In a lot of ways, yes, with Title I. There's a difference with the stabilization fund money, which is a larger pot, but with this money, because of the lack of flexibility, you're kind of stuck with that.
Please continue, Mr. Griffin.
So this is sort of a breakdown. I've tried to create this as a cheat sheet for you so you can go back and look at the PowerPoint and see where the money's going. Some of the first checks that went out were for impact aid. Impact aid is for if you have a military base or federal land in your area that you do not receive any money in lieu of property tax. The federal government provides you with impact aid. In this case, they're allowing the impact aid, the $100 million going out throughout the country for school construction. So here are the school districts that have recently received grants for school construction or improvements in your state. These are increases in IDEA programs. Again, the first set of checks went out in April. This is the one sort of increase that I'm hearing from people will continue on after the 2 years. IDEA, the special ed money, has been underfunded by the feds since it started with its re-op in 97. Their original promise was that the feds would supply 40% of all special education money. They've never supplied actually anything more than about 12%. So this is the attempt by some in the Congress to increase that amount. This increase gets them up to about 24% of special education spending.
Mr. Griffin, Representative Riley has a question.
That funding will continue, because some of us met with our state delegation, some of our members, I was trying to think how far back that was, Representative Slavik, maybe you remember when we met with Representative McCollum, and she said no, and now you're saying yes, which is better news. But so who have you heard that from, and how solid is that?
Well, if it's coming from me, it's not that solid. But I can just tell you sort of the consensus I'm picking up from people, and there's no guarantee with any of this. And part of it's going to be the condition of the budget. Part of it's going to be, quite frankly, who are the chairs of the committee at the time and all that. This was a Kennedy push. And this was something that he thought, talking to his people, that they thought was going to be in the books 2 years ago. But they had to wait till now to get it put in. This, they felt, was going to go ahead anyway, even if the Recovery Act didn't. Now, there's no guarantee, but their feeling was that they can keep this increase going from the future out. Things can change, and it could be wrong. And so, you know, you don't want to spend based on that. But I feel more confident. Now, I've heard mixed things about Title I, so I don't know if that's going through. And I've heard really mixed things about other parts of the Act. But this one seemed a little more stable. So I'd say 75% sure, if you want to put a percentage on it.
Thank you.
For Part B,
medical
funds on by that,
Well, you can come up through legislation, and Kathy knows more about special education than I do, but you can go through within your own code and come up with your definition of special ed, but some of it is locked into IDEA. You can add on to what the identifiers are within your state, but you have to at least follow the federal minimum. And so once a student is identified, and you have to go through the process, you know. So did that answer your question?
Would be, is there any need, because we're under-identifying, do you have any influence on the legislature on that? I know the person's working on that.
Sure. I mean, you could pass legislation that requires greater screening and more sort of counselors dealing with that. You can always add above IDEA, you just couldn't go below. So if you felt you're under-identifying, you could go out there and try to work to identify those students who need it. You just couldn't cut back on your identifications. So. And this is the early Head Start and the Head Start money. Actually, this is the only pot of money that isn't within the education section. This is in the Health and Human Service section. They're still working on the allocations last I checked last week. I'm not too sure why they don't have it broken down for what your state will be getting, but those are the totals that are going out and increases nationally. And here's some of the other smaller grant programs, smaller being a relative term, but you already received your technology state grant of $6.2 million. You should have gotten that April 1st, your vocational rehab grant, your independent service learning and your homeless youth grant. They just came up with those allocations a couple of weeks ago, and I think the checks will be going out fairly soon. They also came out with a whole set of guidelines. My guess is your State Department of Ed is just working on reviewing those right now. Here's the stabilization fund money. This is the big pot of money. This is the one that has the greatest amount of flexibility. The largest group, about $40 billion worth, goes directly to education. $8.8 billion going to high priority needs. That could include education if you want it to. And then finally, the state incentive grant program, which is broken apart into two subparts, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. Your state will be getting $661 million in education funding from this. Here's the thing we found out a couple of weeks ago. So the initial part is, to receive this funding, you have to guarantee that you're funding education at 2005-2006 school year levels. Once you've proven that, then you qualify to receive this funding. You then have to distribute that money out through the state funding formula for 2009-2010 school year and then the 2010-2011. Once you go above 2008-2009 levels for either of those school years, the additional money needs to be distributed out through Title I formulas. Our assumption was that since this money was going to be distributed through your state funding formula, that it would be state funding money. It just becomes state money at that point. And the guidelines they put out about 3 weeks ago, they said no. What happens is the money is distributed out through your funding formula, but it's up to the school districts on how to spend that. So you have no say on how the states spend their education funding from the stabilization fund pot. There's another provision in there that says you can spend this money on anything within that's allowable under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, Title I formula, or IDEA. One of the subsections of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act is the impact aid, which allows you to spend federal money on construction. It's a long way around to telling you your school districts could spend their share of money on new facility construction if they wanted to. And there's not a lot you can do about that. So technically, you could have a school district that decides to lay off teachers and build a new school building with their share of the federal money. That's a problem we didn't see a couple of weeks ago, and quite frankly, it's worrying me a lot, because I'm pretty sure there'll be a couple of school districts in this country that will do that, and I think it's going to make headlines and cause a lot of problems overall. The second pot of money, the high priority needs, you have a complete influence over, essentially. You can distribute this money out how you want to. You could put it in the funding formula, or you could put it out through categorical programs. If you wanted to do a summer school program, if you wanted to do an after school program, a reading program, you could use this money to specifically target that. You can also use this money for just about any other state purpose, with the exception of paying down debt or putting into your rainy day fund. So you could distribute it, you could use it for road building, bridges, healthcare, jails, however you choose. This is just some of the qualifications. The original plan was to get the first set of checks out from the stabilization fund in the summer of this year, and then the next set of checks out late in the fall. Because some states had such bad fiscal years this year, they sped that up, and now the first set of checks are going out in early May, and it's going to be about 67% of the pot of money, and the other 33% will be going out sometime in late summer, early fall, after your state has supplied some details about how they're going to spend their funds. And here's just a little more detail about when the payments are going out. Here are some of the funding requirements to get your first check. I don't want to go over these too quickly. Your governor will be putting this together. Governor's office should be putting this together right now, actually. They received the guidelines and the initial form to fill out, and most states will have this in probably by the end of this week, early next week. The feds have promised once it's in, it's going to be a two-week turnaround, and then you'll receive your first check.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Griffin, Minnesota cut our formula and then put the money back with this money. Did other states do that, or were they more creative?
Every state's been kind of creative. It's a quick answer. A lot of states looked at going back and cutting down to the 05-06 level, even though they didn't have to do that for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. So essentially they could manipulate the dollars. Although I heard a lot of talk about it, there was a lot of sort of studies, quick studies done in states, what do we need to do to get down to that level. No one that I know of has followed through on that. One of the reasons is the feds made it clear a couple of weeks ago that the Race to the Top money, one of their criteria they would be using, even though it's not in the law, is your commitment to education. And if you cut back to 05, 06 levels, they said they'd see this as you're not committing to education. And so that got out there pretty quickly, and states sort of pulled back and said, okay, but did we see a lot of them cut back? Yeah, not that far to 05-06 levels, but they did cut some. Some of it really was financial reasons. Some of it was sort of questionable. Was it financial, or was it done so they could manipulate the dollars? But does that answer your question?
Yeah,
okay. So the second round of funding, you're going to have to come up with your state with a more detailed explanation of where you're going to spend the money, how you're going to spend the money, and how you're going to use those funds to achieve the four education reforms that are put out in the Race to the Top. Let's skip to that. Here are the four education reforms. Bruce kind of talked about this a little bit. You can see these actually were all part of No Child Left Behind. There were provisions and goals set out there in No Child Left Behind that were just made more clear within this language. And it's coming up with high-quality assessments, high-quality data systems, making improvements to teacher effectiveness, including making sure that you're equally distributing highly qualified teachers from district to district and then within districts. And then finally, providing intensive support for failing school districts. These will be the four standards that will be used for the Race to the Top grant. Race to the Top grants are $4.35 billion that they will be giving out to states. The first set of grants will be going out in the fall of this year. The second set of grants will be going out in the spring of this year, which means the applications probably will be going out as soon as about a month and a half, 2 months from now. The question is, we don't know, other than these four qualifications and the fact that they're going to be looking at a general commitment to education, how they're going to judge who are the winning states. We also don't know how many states are going to win. If you're talking about 10 states winning, you're talking about a giant check going to each state. If you're talking about 40 states winning, you're talking about a nice amount, but sort of not a life-changing amount. So it's sort of a difference between, is it going to be a $100 million check or a half a billion dollar check? And we also don't know, you hear rumors out there that the first set of winners have already been chosen. The feds say that's not true, that we don't know who the first set is going to be. We don't have a special list somewhere. We also don't know, are they going to judge you on how you're attempting to achieve these four goals, or are they going to give out the grants to those states that have already achieved these four goals? If they're saying who's already achieved these four goals, there's not a heck of a lot you can do between now and the fall. If it's how you're attempting to achieve this, it's a lot more difficult and sort of opens the door up to a lot more states.
Mr. Griffith, I had heard that part of the intent of Race to the Top was to have states recipients, perhaps in a geographically dispersed way, to provide regional leadership in regards to these four goals. Have you heard anything like that, or is it meant to be just sort of the highlights, certain states as perhaps models of directions that other states can follow? Or
I've heard a ton of rumors. I'll be honest, I just don't know, and we're not getting anything from the feds to clarify it. I mean, one of the things, the initial plan within the legislation said the grants would go out in the fall of next year. They came out with guidelines that said, well, the first set of grants will actually go out in spring or the fall of this year, and then the second group in the spring of next year. So we're kind of curious why they broke it apart that way. And is it that they're going to, in the first set, have three or four states that they want to highlight, that these are the ones, these are high-achieving states, we want you all to emulate them. Then the winners in the second group will be those who emulated the winners from the first group. I've also heard the geographic diversity. I've heard that it's all going to states that are swing states. I've heard it's going to states that have Democratic governors. I've heard it's going to all sorts of things. Honestly, I don't know. When I talk to states out there that think they have an inside line, they seem to feel one way or the other. There are states that think they've already won and they're starting to spend the money. Then there's states that think they have no shot, so they're not even going to bother filling out the application. When you try to probe further and figure out where they're getting this from, it's all just coming from their own personal beliefs. So I wish I knew more about all this. But
and you're the state you guys are located in, Colorado, I understand, passed a series of bills to the at least to the floor of their legislature, perhaps the governor signed them, that it apparently are Race to the Top pieces of legislation. So I think there's perhaps a lot of jockeying and anxiety on the part of different states to call whatever it is that they're doing Race to the Top kind of initiative. Do we have questions from Representative Kowalik?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the public, I have
The way the language does right now, it says the governor's office will apply. So unless they change that, my guess is, and I think they did that to keep it as one central group within the state. And so I don't know. I mean, then I think if that still holds, then it's going to be up to your governor's office if they're going to reach out to the legislature, if they're going to reach out to DOE, you know, if you guys jointly work on it. I think everyone's still kind of hanging back and not too sure how this is going to work. So I wish I could tell you how other states are going forward, but no one really knows right now.
Sure. We're doing that on some of the quality stuff, and we're trying to control through bills, but it is unclear what happens, especially if we adjourn without our bills passing, all kinds of things. Thank you.
Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if we could have a quick moment from Ms. Weber, who's here, because Commissioner Segrin has talked to Representative Ward and myself about a possible proposal from Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota, and I think that was a couple weeks ago. Representative Ward is nodding his head, and so I don't know the status of it, but this might be a chance for us to hear. And then we could ask Mr. Griffith if any questions.
Good morning, Ms. Weber.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Michelle Weber with the Department of Education. And as the presenters today have indicated, we are also getting different messages on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Segrin participated in an NGA conference in Chicago last Friday and got indication that the first round of the Race to the Top grants would be looking at individual states rather than partnerships with states. And so we're still trying to sort things out in terms of what an application from Minnesota might look like.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Weber. to Representative Flawick's question, and I know we talked about that with Representative Ward. At the time, we were thinking of three states. We were looking at, having the legislature, because of the possible partisan nature of the application, making sure we were bipartisan in applying. And, of course, with the different states, that factor would be there with the governors as well. Now, if it would be one state or three, what is the plan of the governor's office to continue making sure we have a bipartisan application? Because we'd all like to plug into that success of our application.
Madam Chair, the governor's office is committed to a bipartisan partnership for the Race to the Top funds, and I know we're also interested at the department level of the possibility of being able to apply for more than one initiative if that is an opportunity. So perhaps partnering with multiple states, depending on the different initiatives that we might want to put forward. The CCSSO does have regular communication with all the state chief officers, and they have been facilitating discussions so that states can be learning what each of them are interested in, where they might want to form partnerships on the different initiatives that might be considered.
And then finally, Mr. Chair, Ms. Weber, maybe you could tell the others who weren't at the meeting, Representative Ward and myself, just the thumbnail sketch of Minnesota application, whether it's with or without the other two states.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, unfortunately, I do not know. I don't know the details of that. I know there's been discussion, but that discussion has been happening at the commissioner level.
Thank Mr. Griffin, it looked like you were going to jump in.
I was just going to say, there is a provision within the legislation that says priorities will be given to states that work together on their application or something like that. I can't remember the exact wording, so that's probably what, does that initiate you guys working together?
Yes.
And so we've heard it from a lot of states that are looking at this. It sounds like you guys are actually a little further ahead than some of the others, where they're trying just to figure out, does that mean we have to put in a joint application together, or can we just show that we worked together while we came up with our own application? Again, I think states are kind of grappling in the dark for
Mr. Griffith, do you know anything about, and I know this is highly speculative, and I apologize for asking speculative questions in a formal hearing, but some of the kind of whisperings I've heard for well over half a year has to do with a strong interest by some in Congress, I'm not sure about this administration, in moving towards some kind of national assessment system. Now, one of the criticisms of the NCLB framework is that we have 50 sets of standards and 50 assessment systems, and that there's been grumblings among some kind of congressional leaders that's a flawed way for us to invest federal and national resources. Anything on that? Or Ms.
I can ask.
I think our take on that is that we are hearing rumblings from across the state for a voluntary state initiative for standards, where it would not be stemming from the federal level, but would generate up from agreement across the state.
And whether there's a connection to the Race to the Top is a further speculative question I won't ask.
Actually, one of the points I'm going to bring up when I talk about the exit exams is, for example, I guess not exit exams, but I know that someone had a question about computer adaptive exams, so I just came prepared to answer that one. But I will tell you that Delaware just put out an RFP for the development of a computer adaptive exam that they can use, and they are talking about potentially collaborating with other states. If you would, I'm just throwing this out, but here's a thought. If a state like that, and if you're struggling with your exit exam system or whether to move to end of course, that sort of thing, you could actually collaborate with other states. They're talking about sharing end of course exams with other states. Why reinvent the wheel if you have similar standards and you're trying to save costs in the first place? I'm sure that's not a ignorable feature of an application if states are working to improve the exams, improve the validity and the reliability, and yet save money. So I'm guessing that would probably hit a nice button with them.
It's very intriguing. We are indeed struggling with those issues, and we also currently have a proposal on the table with the computer adaptive test framework with the executive branch is extremely interested in. We're going to try to wrap up Mr. Griffith's testimony, but I do have Representative Detmer, and then we'll
finish up. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question for Mr. Griffith. You mentioned the feds several times. What makes up, is it a committee? Is it just one person? Who are we talking about?
Right now, it's in the hands of the Department of Education. And so it's, when I mention feds, that's what I'm, it's the USDOE. And what it is they, the bill itself, even though it's 200 pages of education, it really wasn't fleshed out enough. So the DOE right now is coming up with a structure defining a lot of the things that are going on, talking about when the money's going to be distributed, and that's what they're spending their time doing right now. And so they are actually, in the past, I'd say 5 weeks, each week there's something new coming out about the Recovery Act, clearer guidelines, better understanding. They also have said that they're working with the skeleton staff right now. They're still appointing their people. And so they're taking multiple shots at some of these things. And that's why you're hearing from people like me with varying answers at different times, because they actually are changing as they're moving along. These are three of the smaller grant programs. Again, small is a relative definition, but $250 million for statewide data systems, and then two different teacher programs. They haven't come up with the guidelines or the structures for these yet. My guess is these are going to be put on hold until later in the summer once they get past some of the larger programs. This is the state incentive grant or the Race to the Top programs that we talked about. And then the other program is $650 million for Innovation Fund, which is to go to school districts who are working with nonprofit groups that have shown a clear track record of student achievement. These will go directly to your school districts. It's still not clear how they're going to apply and if they're going to have to apply in conjunction with a nonprofit group, but you might hear a lot from your districts about this as it moves forward. And that's the end. I think we did it a little over 10 minutes.
Just a bit over 10 minutes, Mr. Griffin. Thank you for a very comprehensive presentation, and obviously it stimulated a lot of interest in a number of issues. Thank you for that. Dr. Vandell.
Now I'd like to move on to Kathy Christie, who's going to talk to you about two issues, specifically related, as she mentioned, the issue of high school exit exams versus end of course assessments. I know that's an issue that you're struggling with right now. And also there were some questions from members of the committee around the issue of co-location of services in social services in schools. And so she'll be prepared to talk to you for a few minutes on each of those topics.
Very well. We are scheduled to adjourn in a little over 35 minutes, so we should hopefully have good time. Please proceed. And members, I've been asked for those, particularly this often happens for those members who are sitting on the inside of the table, please use your mic. We are recording the proceedings, and there are people listening elsewhere, and it's hard to pick up when we're not using our mic. Ms. Christie.
I just want to give you a very, very quick overview of where the states are with exit exams, and I don't have a PowerPoint, so you stuck with the blue up here now. Our real expert on this is Jennifer Downey, who runs our high school policy work. She happened to have gotten married over the weekend, so I don't know why she's not here. She can give you all this off the top of her head. I have to use some notes, so... the number of states that now require passage of an exit exam for high school graduation, 24. Most of those are testing the two core areas, reading and math, although we're seeing a little bit of growth with some states expanding beyond that. For example, Massachusetts is English, math, science in 2010, and they're going to add history in 2012. There are a number of states now, 10, that use end-of-course exams as their exit exam, rather than one single broad one at the end of your high school career or at whatever level that you decide to use those end-of-course ones, which keep it closer to the student. There are states that use them for other purposes other than just high school graduation. High school accountability, for example. There are six states that use them as keep the exit exam score as part of the course grade.
the level of diploma. There are 6 states that use them for an honors or an advanced diploma. 3 of them use them for scholarship eligibility. Most of the single high school exit exams range anywhere from 6th grade level to 11th grade level. As we get into the end of course tests, that's one of the reasons for considering the end of course test, because you really are raising the bar on the exam. There are 19 states that require or either provide funding or require local school districts to provide remediation. 10 states require that a student who does not pass must participate in remediation. The number of chances to retake, most of the states do allow that. The pass rates across the country range anywhere from 71% to 99%. And of course, you have to take those with a grain of salt, because you don't know where the test scores have been, you don't know what the rigor of it. If you're testing at 6th grade level, I would hope that 99% would pass. But that is the range when I looked quickly back at our data. 16 states have the scores reported on the student transcripts. And there are states that have a special appeal process or other measures allowed to demonstrate proficiency. There are 7 states that have reciprocity with other states. If you accept my test, we'll accept yours for students who move back and forth. That's been a big issue across the states, and I think it's kind of a separate one, but with military children. 12 allow students to pass a different exam. 7 allow students to appeal their scores by using grades or other factors. 7 states use some other evaluation of classroom evidence as part of that appeal, if you do that. 2 states, and this is an interesting one, 2 states actually allow accommodations for their regular students, not students with special needs, but their regular students. So, for example, if you have a student who just reads really slowly, doesn't mean that they don't necessarily have the content, but if they are having trouble passing just because they can't get through the text. 9 issue an alternative diploma or certificate to general ed students, not students with disabilities, to general ed students who do not pass the exit exam but who pass other graduation requirements. So that's the overall on the exit exams before I move into end of course. If anyone have questions on that?
Any questions for any members? So, yes, Representative Wigger, Representative Ward, or Senator Wigger.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Christie. In the context of best practices and the 4 education reforms that the federal government's looking at and will use as a big influence in awarding grants, what would be recommended for a state in looking at end of course, exams, et cetera? You mentioned the variety of approaches, but given all the research that's been done, what would your recommendations be for a state legislature like us that's looking at future direction?
Well, actually, one of the next things I wanted to tick through very quickly, if that's possible, is to go through the American Education Research Association has set 12 standards for assessment.
Why don't we, I'm sorry, Ms. Christie, why don't we get Representative Ward's question, and then we'll move to that, because it sounds like part of your answer to Senator Wigger.
It is. It's very tied in.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question. Ms. Christie, would you be able to get to our staff or to Chair Mariani or somebody just the data that you presented to us a minute ago so that we can all get that?
Absolutely, and I can tell you where to get to it. If you go to ecs.org on the main page, bottom right, there's a little link to all of our high school databases. We have all the graduation requirements. We have whether they're college-ready standards. It's an unbelievable amount of state policy data, and the exit exams is one feature of that. So you can just click through, you can get, and I can leave this if you want. This is actually a profile of every state system. Minnesota's in here. Most of these were updated. This one, the last update, probably happened last year.
Very well. It looks like Dr. Vandal is trying to also visually get us
there. Oh, we have an actual connection?
Yep, there it is.
Oh, we do.
You just click on that, and there's our high school policy.
So, and you have a little graphic in your packets. Any one of those you can drill down into and get 50 state data. 50 state on advanced placement, 50 state on the college-ready standards, 50 state on the
every single piece of graduation requirements, the exit exams, the end of course exams, all of that. So it's a wealth of information fully available to you any time of day. Just click into it. Or have your staff click into it. Probably easier.
Thank you, Ms. Christie. Why don't you proceed, and then we'll hopefully get to the center winner.
Okay. What I wanted to do was just quickly run through. There are some of the AERA standards that are more pertinent to the end of course conversation than others. One, their first one, and these are honed down elements of the 12 standards, but protection against high stakes decisions based on a single test. So with the researchers, this is a concern that you don't have one of the hugest decisions affecting kids' lives made on a single exam. This one does have implications for using an end-of-course test rather than a single high school exit exam. So, for example, you're the only state, I believe, that leaves the number of retakes up to districts. Most of the other states will say you have one to exponential number of times to retake. So you need to make sure that you have the ability to retake probably for either a single exit exam or an end of course. That's a big feature to make sure you have in place. The second one is adequate resources and opportunity to learn. Again, this one really ties and gives a nudge up for using end of course tests. Because then you're absolutely explicitly tying it to instruction. One of the concerns out there is when you have students who are not exposed to the curriculum that you're testing. It is the way to absolutely ensure that you are doing that. Validation for each separate intended use. This one, not so much with the end of course. You need to do this on all of them, but my guess is in any Race to the Top application, or if you're really going for college-ready assessments that are going to be highly valid, this is a piece that you need to make sure has been vetted within the state. Full disclosure of likely negative consequences of high-stakes testing programs, that's their number four. Again, that applies to both a single exam or end of course. And one of these is for testing companies, and so anytime you're talking to a contractor, make sure that they really explicate that for you. What are the potential downsides of using this exam? The fifth one is another one that really has implications for the use of end-of-course tests, and that is there needs to be alignment between the test and the curriculum. And again, you're absolutely assured when it's an end-of-course test that's geared for that particular test, for that particular course. Now, there are, you know, you would have the option of having those be district-developed where you're not getting the value of an end-of-course test because you're still not having consistency from district to district. But if you have a state-adopted set of end-of-course tests, then you absolutely ensure that. Their sixth one is validity of passing scores and achievement levels, and I know in every single state where to set the cut scores is a huge issue. That one's going to be with your single exit exam or with your end-of-course test. But those things, they're not set in stone. There's no one out there that has absolutely the right answer. And so some of the states, like I think it was Massachusetts, that started with a fairly low bar, and then as they saw how things were going, they just incrementally raised it. Something to think about in the long term. Massachusetts, I did want to highlight, has a piece in law in their legislative code that says that they want their standards to, and this is a quote, be constructed with due regard to the work and recommendations of national organizations, to the best of similar efforts in other states, and to the level of skills, competencies, and knowledge possessed by typical students in the most educationally advanced nations. And that's in statute. The seventh one from AERA is opportunities for meaningful remediation for examinees who fail high-stakes tests. So to make sure that component is there, that you're not just casting the students who failed to the wolves, that there are opportunities and funded opportunities, and the next step on that, which is requiring those darn kids to get those opportunities and take advantage of them, having survived two teenagers who are now very well-adjusted adults, but as teenagers, you know, sometimes they need that extra push to hold their feet to the fire. And that's another piece that the end-of-course test does approach does well is it's closer to them, it's applied to the classes that they're in now, and it is another way to hold their feet to the fire. But the remediation piece is big. Number eight, appropriate attention to language differences among examinees. Obviously, in any race to the top applications or whatever, that's an important thing to have. Again, applies to single or end of course, though. Nine is appropriate attention to students with disabilities. Very similar. Same thing. 10, careful adherence to explicit rules for determining which students are to be tested. Under NCOB, there's, you know, this came out in 2000, I believe, preceded NCOB, so now you're testing all kids. But for high school graduation, that is a big deal. 11, sufficient reliability for each intended use. So if you are using it for more, if you're using it for school accountability, if you're trying to use them for diagnostic exams, those things don't always go together. And it's your testing experts who can tell you more about that. 12, ongoing evaluation of intended and unintended effects of the high school test or high stakes testing. So no matter whether you use the single exit exam or an end of course, having a study into, okay, what are our pass-fail rates? What are we doing about that? How are the districts handling that is very important. So those are the 12 AERA, but some of those really do. If you even gauged an application around something like that, it's going to help give you some credibility. The other piece, if you haven't seen it yet, that Russell Whitehurst, who used to be with the Institute for Education Sciences, said that he was really pushing for anything to have an evaluative component of it. And I would guess that that will also give you a leg up if you do that.
Thank you, Ms. Christie. And so, again, if we were to look for those recommended standards, we would find those on your website?
Actually, those are not up yet. This is a draft of a policy brief that is we've not yet released. Since Jennifer is out on a honeymoon for like 3 weeks, I'm going to try to see if I can, if we can get it finished up. It actually is just loaded with good information about what other states are doing. So we'll try to get this up on our site shortly.
If you would be so kind, that would be helpful in sort of getting it up perhaps on your website, even if you're able to transmit that to us. We will be, in fact, grappling with this issue. We are grappling with it right now. We will intensely be grappling with it over the course of the next couple of weeks. We have a question from Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Christie, this may not be in your purview, but what I'm interested in is you've been talking about end of course mostly in the context as a substitute for a high stakes exam and in the context of the race to the top applications, mm-hmm. and I'd like to back up a step and see if you know anything about the pedagogy of end of course exams, and that's outside of the use of end of course exams as a high stakes test. Is there a progressive transition that's recommended for the use of that tool before you reach that threshold of making it a high stakes test?
Oh, you mean like having them in place prior to that?
Working with end of course exams in purpose. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. As in terms of their role in course completion and course curriculum development, that kind of relationship before you come from the kind of outside mm-hmm. in with the end of course exam as a high stakes tool.
I don't think there's anything written in stone as to what the progression should be, but I can tell you there are states that use end-of-course tests without having them be high stakes for graduation. They're high stakes for having validated the time that your rear was in the chair in that classroom, so they're used that way for, but they're not all used for high stakes by any stretch.
And maybe, Mr. Chair, maybe I need to look at some further research here, but I don't think the seat time is the issue, but the outcomes measures, and that to me seems to be the first step you ought to be looking at with an end-of-course exam, is their effectiveness as outcomes measures for the course, instead of coming backward as a high-stakes test and then trying to redo your curriculum, but to work upward, and I'm just wondering what the literature says about that, but
Again, I haven't seen anything that specifies which are best. I mean, the model for doing it is advanced placement, where you have a syllabus-driven course, and then you have an assessment that tests on exactly what those students were told they were going to need to know and be able to do at the beginning. So that is the model. I think, again, any course, and it's one of the things that resonates with me with Delaware, looking at maybe using someone else's. You know, if you already see a state that's getting good academic results, has assured that their tests are already tied to their standards and the outcomes that they want for their kids, you know, do you have to start from scratch and reinvent them? But you're absolutely right. That is a very, very important feature, to make sure that they're testing what it is, what you're expecting your students at that grade level in that course to know and be able to do. The fact that they come from the state level does bring the value of consistency and reliability from course to course. So if I'm taking algebra in Coon Rapids, I can be assured that if I go take algebra in a Minneapolis school, I'm getting the same course.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're going to move on to the last part of the presentation. Is that correct?
Which is me again. I'm sorry.
Yes, it is. Okay.
There are the question was about co-location of services, and there have been any number of states, including Minnesota. I saw, I think, in 2002 or so, that asked for a task force examination, if I'm not mistaken. And where that generated from, whether that was from the legislature or the State Department, I'm not sure. But a lot of states have taken a look at how better to serve the full needs of kids in schools. And it's one of the great criticisms out there. And politically, if you want to earn great points against across your whole community, it is one to look at, because there's such concern with kids who are coming to school hungry or not feeling well or having bad teeth or whatever coming into school. So I just want to preface this by there's task forces, there are commitments to more voluntarily sharing services, state agencies working together. Iowa has an initiative of doing that at the state level to try to make sure that the state agencies are working together. There are programs like Communities and Schools, which is has been around for a long time, but it's a program. It's not state-supported necessarily. It's not state-mandated. It is generates from the district up and does exactly, I think, what the program I'm going to describe does. But the one state that has had in place for as long as anyone is Kentucky. When their whole education system was toppled and found unconstitutional in 88 or 89, they had to totally rewrite their state code. And a piece of it was that schools will have family resource centers to serve the families in that neighborhood. They have since, just in 2008, they added a whole new section or two to their policy provisions, and that's what I want to touch on here real quickly, is where they draw the bar, how much it costs, and that sort of thing. So backing up with Kentucky, they have two levels. They have one for elementary schools, which are called the family resource centers, and they have another type that's for the secondary schools, for middle and high school, called youth service centers. They have to be in or near any school 20% free and reduced lunch or higher. 20% is pretty low. If you look at your communities, it's pretty low. So they have set a fairly low threshold. What they do is they have to identify and coordinate the following things. Here's the elementary level list, and this isn't all of them, but it's most of them. Identify and coordinate child care for 2 and 3 year olds, after school care for 4 to 12 year olds, provide education programs for families in training, so integrated home visits, monitoring child development of kids in a household, especially for new and expectant parents. They have family literacy and health services or referrals. One of the things I saw in their
the graphical report on the whole system is, and I loved this because with low-income families you run into quite a bit of it, grandparent support group, which is not something I've really heard of much in the past, but so when you have grandparents who are raising these little kids, at least having a support system for them, you know, great idea. The youth center, service centers are a little bit different. They have, again, referrals to health and social service, career exploration and development, summer and part-time job development for their high school students, and substance abuse and education counseling. And then they added another new section that requires continuing education for the coordinators and the staff. The big key is the coordinator at each one of these schools. And that doesn't mean that if you have like a middle school and a high school that are close together, they might share one of these centers and have that serve both schools. The districts apply. They do have to submit an application. I'm told it's not competitive, but they do have to apply, and then the applications are actually evaluated. They're not, you know, not against your district and my district, but to make sure that there are key elements that are there. It's almost fully funded by the state dollars. Anything that's not funded by state dollars is kind of extra fundraising that they've done. The minimum amount is $34,155. The maximum amount for any grant is $93,150. That's for this year. They have a line item in the Department of Education budget. That's where the money's put. Here's something that's really unusual. The money is transferred from there to the Department of, to the Cabinet of Health and Human Services. And an unusual way to think about it, but I'm told that what it does is it keeps those two agencies talking to each other. They are required to have a full-time coordinator at any one of the sites. There are 1,250 to 1,260 schools that qualify. They are currently funding 820 sites. There are 15 sites this year that didn't get funded because there weren't enough dollars to go around. Here's the ultimate cost at the state level, and it's big. But if you're looking at race to the top funds or you're looking at a way to do this, it's something to consider. For Kentucky, it's over $57 million to fund this annually. So it comes with a high price tag, there's no doubt. There is another state that is moving ahead. Louisiana has what they call a no wrong door policy, which is very similar. It's integrated case management, health and hospitals, social services, labor, youth services, and education. And in 2008, they passed a new piece, which is a neighborhood place component, but so much more limited than Kentucky because it is, they have 9 regions across the state, and there's only one, quote-unquote, neighborhood place across each region, which to me is not getting to the level that Kentucky is getting. But similar services, student achievement, truancy and dropout prevention, preventative health care, adult education, and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to bring the Kentucky example to you. It is very costly, and yet, because you are brokering these types of services, one of the things that districts struggle with, and I was on a local board for over 12 years, is how do you pay for that at the district level? So state support or using some federal dollars. Most of the community and school programs, I believe, are getting federal dollars to help fund their actual programs. But if you want a state example, somebody to look at who's doing it statewide, big time, and putting the money behind it, it is absolutely Kentucky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just commenting to Representative Barling that in our state we have many of these components. They're just not centralized, coordinated, and I'm pretty confident saying that our investment members, everything from ECFE to after-school programming, the literacy efforts, many of our child care efforts that involve early education, easily surpassed the $57 million, but the framework is not it certainly isn't a state mandate that all will be coordinated. Representative Gravel was saying that in many districts you'll have coordination happening and co-location of many of those services at a school site, but that's, you know, it's a district-to-district type of feature. It's certainly not a state, you know, directed or state expectation. Members, any questions or thoughts or reactions? Representative Ward and Senator Wiggins.
Just a quick comment or question. I'm not even sure what it is, but as I've been sitting here, I've been thinking about there's a constituent of mine that has he has talked to a number of folks in this room, a vocational program, K through post-secondary. I know that there's another growth and justice program out there with Smart Investments in Minnesota Children. I know some service learning components, but there's other options and there are other ideas out there. And I look at your screen there that says advancing ideas. Do you connect with those folks as well and implement some of their positions or ideas into your concepts and philosophies and helping advance some of those ideas?
Yeah.
How?
That's part of the education system, the K-12 education system, and we do look at all of that. And in some cases in states that's sewn in within the traditional K-12, in other cases it exists just outside or maybe even in a different department. Corrections education, for instance, is completely different. So we do take that into account when we look at different philosophies, different ideas that are coming through. Kathy, I don't know if you said anything for this particular presentation, but we do take that into account.
No, I mean, as Bruce described earlier, we have a citizenship and service learning division at HCS. What we try to bring to the table is the best knowledge available on what's getting the best results. And politics aside, because we are absolutely 100% nonpartisan. So we're just trying to bring the best information to you, and then you get to consider, you know, what you're going to do with that.
One last comment. A good example of some of those organizations that you talk about, we've done recently some work in Ohio where they have developed a structure of regional P16 councils that are very much focused on bringing in all those agencies together within regions, given specific economic demands, specific population circumstances, and said, how can we do a better job of aligning all of our resources in some way that's leading to higher education achievement levels and also preparation for the workforce? And so what's fascinating about that is they're putting on the table, for example, one in Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky, is saying, let's look at all the streams of revenue that we get as organizations. Think about what we're doing and think about ways to better align those resources in a way so that we're achieving a single set of goals around academic achievement, workforce preparation, college readiness, etc. And I think those are an interesting model. I know Minnesota has a pretty strong P16 council statewide, but regionally there's some interesting things happening in many states where they're bringing those key parties together to have those conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to switch to another topic on teachers.
Oh, okay. Before you do that, Mr. Remo, was your question on this point, or...
Mr. Chair, no, mine was just a general comment.
Okay, so Senator Wicker and then Senator Rummel and Mr. Browning, and then by then I suspect we'll be done. So.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as mentioned, a few of us serve as legislative reps to your organization. And at the meeting I was at, I was so impressed that you invited the Teachers of the Year throughout America. And I found that to be the best part of the conference and the formal and informal exchange of information. Could you, each of you, just share some thoughts on where we're going with the training of highly effective teachers, the recruitment, and the whole movement, as that ultimately is the most important thing we can do?
The big issue in this legislature, for sure.
Well, I can tell you that one of the speakers we're having this summer is Alan Auden, who is talking about human capital and how we get there. With some very different concepts about managing human capital, and I'll leave it to his expertise to talk about that. We also have another project right now where we just finished, during our last blizzard, which preceded the one this last weekend, bringing some strong thinkers from around the country, from business, from the corporate world, from the National Chamber of Commerce, testing. I think we had a scientist there, to think about all of the policies that have gone into supporting effective teachers. Why have they
why do we keep coming up against kind of a ceiling on how broad the application is of that? So we're getting ready to move forward with the next generation of that work based on some of the recommendations that they're coming up with. But as you know, I mean, it's tough, and it all gets down to that individual teacher who is in that individual classroom. And I can tell you that the research says that there's more unevenness within schools than there is between and among teams.
Just one last comment. We'll be releasing a paper in May that myself and a colleague of mine have developed on how you can more effectively develop stronger partnerships and linkages between teacher preparation programs and school districts. With the evolution of data systems as they are, creating teacher identifier numbers as well as student ID numbers, we can get better data about how well teachers coming out of particular teacher preparation programs are performing in specific schools. And we're arguing that we shouldn't be using it for rigorous accountability in terms of slapping wrists, but more as a vehicle to create stronger and better partnerships between school districts and teacher preparation programs by having better data about how well teachers are performing in schools as a way to set up induction programs, professional development for new teachers, and also professional development for existing teachers to create a greater connection and alignment between what's coming out of those programs and what the schools need. And so that's another area that we think is very interesting.
We'll look forward to that. Senator Rubble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the panel for taking us on a whirlwind tour through many of the tensions that face us as education policymakers. We began with the soft skills that we need our students to have in addition to the content knowledge. And then we moved into a discussion about, and of course, testing. And I have had a number of people coming into my office, including the state demographer, among others, saying, you know, with all our emphasis on whether it's testing on scores and stuff, we are actually losing the creativity and the flexibility that set this country apart. And it's not one or the other. But I think we do want to recognize that we can sometimes get so focused on the one, whether it's testing or high stakes or whatever, and miss the big picture of the other. And then you took us, and I was so grateful, you took us to the community of schools, and we began with talking about international comparisons. And again, here's another tension. We are trying to race to the top to be with those top-scoring countries, and yet when we look at international comparisons, the United States, among the developed countries, has the highest percentage of really poor kids. We are the richest third world country on the planet, and we are not dealing with some of those issues very effectively. So the complexity of what we are facing is enormous, and we have to remember that one or two of these programs needs to be integrated into the larger picture that's before us. So I appreciate what you're bringing to us, but I hope we don't lose sight of some of those big problems.
Thank you. Well said, Senator Rummel. And then I want a comment or query from Mr. Senator Gravel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to also thank you for coming. And I wish that Representative Downey hadn't had to leave early, probably for something else, because I wanted to show an example of how important your work is. Something that happened here this year in Minnesota. Representative Swales carried some legislation on, along with Senator Wieger in the Senate for P16 councils. And we've been trying for the last couple of years, as you may know, to get legislators at the table. And we were able to, he asked, you know, what research is there that even shows that legislators should be involved? The case was some were making that it was politicized and so forth. And so when we were able to point to your very good research, that actually research shows the most important thing is a governor's support and involvement, and then the next most important thing is legislative involvement, you know, that was all Representative Downey needed to know. A nice bipartisan fact based on research coming from the Education Commission of the states that our very own governor chairs at this time. So there are many things. Also, Representative Mariani mentioned when Mr. Griffin was here a couple of summers ago to help us with the legislation that's now our, we call our new Minnesota miracle, that hopefully we'll get into statute this year. It's just invaluable, the work that you do. So thank you for coming to Minnesota.
Thank you very much.
Members, I want to thank the, we have three committees gathered here today. It's very unusual. I want to thank our senator from the K-12 Policy and Finance Committee in the Senate for being here with us, and then members from both the House K-12 Finance and Policy Committee as well. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Griffin, my dear friend, Dr. Vandell, Ms. Christie, for being with us today. We look forward to ongoing engagement with you. I actually want to follow up with you very specifically in regards to how we as a legislature can continue to be involved in the constantly evolving nature of the federal government's involvement. It's currently captured with the Reinvestment Stimulus Act, but obviously it's going to carry forward. And I'm a very zealous member of the legislative branch, where I think I actually believe the legislative branch is equal to the executive branch, and that's how I was taught in grade school. And I believe that firmly. I think it's very important that we continue to be at the table with the federal government as a legislative voice in regards to shaping what things like Race to the Top and ongoing investments will look like throughout the rest of the year. We look forward to your advice on how we can continue to do that. Thank you so very much for being with us today and bringing us very valuable information, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your stay here in our wonderful northern state for the rest of the tenure of your conference. With that, members, we are adjourned.